Welcome to Trauma Informed Caring and Essential Conversations podcast, brought to you by the Mid-America Addiction Technology Transfer Center, funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Although funded by SAMHSA, the content on this podcast does not necessarily reflect the views of SAMHSA.
We have seen that well-being inspires well-doing. And so at the beginning of every podcast, we like to take a moment and center ourselves. So I invite you, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, if you can, pause, get comfortable in your seat. You might want to press your toes deeply into the ground to give your brain the message that you are safe. If you can close your eyes, go ahead and do so. And let's just take a few deep, slow, even breaths together. Inhale and exhale. In through your nose, out through your pursed lips. Inhale. Exhale. And now as you continue breathing slowly and deeply, just notice anywhere in your body there's tension. Without judgment, notice, and if you need to, move that part of your body. You might want to shrug your shoulders or roll them back. You might want to arch your back. You might want to stretch your hands or your forearms. You might want to just reach up and make yourself as tall as you can. You might want to roll your wrists or ankles. Whatever attention your body needs, with an attitude of kindness, go ahead and give that to yourself. And when you feel complete with that exercise, I invite you to take one more deep breath in. And as you breathe out, you may open your eyes and release this practice. I am Roxanne Pendleton.
And I'm Andrea Dalton.
And this is Trauma Informed Caring.
Welcome back to another episode of Trauma Informed Caring. And this season, we are focusing on trauma informed caring in unexpected places. So today, we're going to explore the legal system a little bit and some unique programming that's happening. And so we're really excited for you to get into this conversation with us, with our guests today, as we explore these varied perspectives and nurture knowledge and inspire courage for practical transformative action, which is our mission of this podcast. So as we get started, I'll ask our guests to introduce themselves today. We'll start with Judge Kreitz.
Hi, I'm Dan Kreitz. I'm the district judge and the chief judge in the 31st Judicial District of Kansas. That includes Allen, Woodson, Wilson, and Neosho counties. I practiced law 17 years. I've been on the bench almost 22 years now. And I have a very general docket besides a drug court, which I think we're primarily going to focus on today, which Troy Smith, our drug court director, is going to tell you a little bit more about that, I'm sure. But it's a great program. A tremendous success due to a lot of unbelievable staff. So I'm honored to serve as a judge. I love my job and I really enjoy drug court. It's where you think you can actually make a difference in lives. And it's a difference maker for me in a professional sense.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
My name is Troy Smith. I am the Director of Community Corrections, Juvenile Services, and the 31st Judicial District Drug Court Program. So we also service the 31st Judicial District in community corrections. That is adult probation for those convicted of a felony who are both high risk and high need at the time of sentencing. So we do just higher level felonies and higher level offenders. On juvenile side, we run several programs. We have an IIP program, which is an enhanced diversion project that's run through the state. We have a truancy program, which is preventative in nature. And then we also do juvenile intensive supervision. So, and those are also kids that are found to be high risk and high need at the time of disposition. And then, of course, I am principally in charge of the drug court. And I was an intensive supervision officer for about 17 years. And I've now been the director of all of these services for going on 6 years. That's crazy. Been 6 years, but 6 years. So that's what I do.
Roy, thank you for your service.
All right. I'm very excited because you both have so much fantastic experience. And we don't get to talk to people, I feel like, that often who are working in the areas that you're working in, because most of our work has been with kind of the other side of things, you know, the treatment programs themselves, or, you know, so both of us have worked in inpatient behavioral health, and, you know, it's just kind of a different experience. So I'm excited to hear more from your expertise and your experience. So the first question I want to ask then is, how did you get started with trauma-informed care in your work? How, you know, what inspired that, or how did it come to be that you got interested in trauma-informed care?
On the probation side, for many, many years, the probation paradigm was one of compliance. Mm-hmm. So a client came in, you basically spoke to them about compliance. Have you done this? Have you done that? Have you not done this? Have you not done that? And that was the world in which we existed. What I found myself, and then obviously the Kansas Department of Corrections has changed a lot of their policies and the way they do business as well, was that just doing compliance-based probation doesn't work. So we have moved now to an era of evidence-based practices and cognitive modeling, things that we can do to better serve the clients that we have. So, and you can't properly address the ongoing needs of a client unless you're aware of the trauma they may or may not have experienced. So that what got me interested is most was just responsivity to the programming I was trying to give was being directly affected by things that were sometimes beyond my control and many times beyond my knowledge of what was going on with the folks who entered the system. So that's what originally got me very, very interested in it, was just being more successful with the clientele that we work with.
And for me, I think it was initially when I went to the Nashville Judicial College in Reno, Nevada, and saw drug court work before we even created our drug court, and saw the judge and his relationship with the particular individuals in court, and how he, for lack of a better term, coached them, but also was an enforcer with them. And huge program, very successful. And years later, then we created the program. And so we've tried to follow that. And important to understand, Troy deals with them on a daily basis. And I deal with them when they're in court. And we have drug court here, you know, twice a month. And so I have snapshots in time. I have a lot of information given to me that I can talk to them about and try and get them to talk to me about, more importantly. But it's a snapshot. I don't have that time with them every day or three times a week or even more. So
I think that leads me to another question about that in particular. So with that sort of, I don't know, more intermittent interaction with people, what sorts of strategies have you found that are, you know, connected with being more trauma-informed that have been really helpful in those kind of short-term spread out contacts that you have with people?
You try and take bits and pieces of information in your mind, but you don't want to give You want to use very general questions, open-ended questions, and you want them to provide the information. Then you try and, you know, talk to them about that and ask them, you know, did you make, so do you think that was a mistake when you did this? Or, you know, that sort of thing. You just want to get the information, have them communicate with you, and you've got to listen to them. And then as they answer, you know, kind of lead them along to the next question you want to ask us. Generally speaking, you're talking 3 to 5 minutes in drug court with each defendant. I mean, that's what the national standards are. And we do a good job of abiding by those. And we have a lot of people on the docket. So we're doing them in a short time frame. So, mm-hmm. you know, we try and stay focused. But I want to know if they're going to share with us what they've actually had success with, and I'm going to praise them about, or how they failed. I mean, why did you fail that drug test? Why did you use marijuana or methamphetamine to deal with that situation? And we'll talk a little bit about that. And then they'll see what they say to me. So
it sounds like what you're describing is a shift from a lecture focused encounter to a conversation focused encounter, where in the past, the practice may have been, you know, you're the expert and you decree, versus we are collaborating now together. You're the expert on the law. They're the expert on their lives. You're bringing the information together and working together on a solution or on a next step. Would that be a way to say that?
And I think that's accurate generally with more difficult to get information out of.
Sure.
And they just don't communicate. So then I do have to kind of lead them a little bit more and pry them a little bit more, and then see what they'll share. But yes, it's conversation based. I'm trying to get them to talk. I'm trying to get, they're in court in front of all their cohorts and co-defendants in drug court. Ours is a post-sentence court. We offer diversions, so pre-sentence, we offer that, or pre-prosecution, basically, they could go into diversion, but our prosecutors in our area have never opted for that option, and they have the control of that, so ours is all post-conviction. Mm-hmm. So.
And I think obviously, the most effective means of communication with our folks or of getting levels of compliance from them is from the good words they hear from the judge. Everybody likes to have a judge tell you that you're doing well. Everybody likes to, and the judge does a great job of, even when we are having people that, you know, it's just negative information after negative information after negative information, he always finds a way at the end to give them something to walk away with. And court has, for so many of our folks, been a completely adversarial process, one where they didn't feel like they have a voice, one where they didn't feel like they have any control over what's happening to them in their lives. So this is conversation where the judge is listening to them. They're getting to speak directly to him. They're getting to say things that they normally wouldn't get a chance to say. Because as a defendant in the courtroom, most of the time you walk in, your defense attorney says, shut up and let me do the talking. Mm-hmm. And in this case, it's a conversation, and I interject into that conversation occasionally. By the time a person has been in the court for a pretty significant amount of time, there is a rapport that's developed. We know what to expect from them. They know what to expect from us. So we accentuate the positives during their court appearances.
To sidelight and to make it clear, you know, when I'm talking to them in court, they have an attorney with them. We have court-appointed attorneys. So they have an attorney there that's been able to advise them and talk to them, and they have an idea what might be ahead. I mean, we come up with recommendations. We can talk about the staffing and drug court a little bit and how the structure is, so it's maybe a little more understandable. But Troy is exactly right. Now, I think he's overpraising me for my work, but I really try and find, a lack of a better term, a hook for these individuals. So every time they're in court, I try and figure out a way to get a smile out of them, get them mm-hmm. to agree to something, mm-hmm. or, you know, find something positive. So many of these people have had no positives in their lives and really have not had a chance. And that's clear from the numerous, well, I don't know how many graduations we've had now, but a lot. I'm looking for positives. I'm trying to make them find their way to recovery. And everybody's path is individualistic. There's no set pattern. I mean, everybody's recovery is individualistic. And I try and keep that in mind. It's too easy to put people in boxes and say, everybody ought to be in this box. Well, no, we're individuals. And everybody's lives have been lived differently. So.
Yeah.
Who is overpraising you at all? I mean,
I don't think so either. I think you need to learn to receive compliments, Judge. Wait, that was not a trauma-informed way to say that. I invite you to open yourself as you're comfortable to receiving praise.
Well, yesterday when I walked in the morning, it was interesting. I had a graduate that I hadn't seen her in over 3 years. She graduated from drug court and she came up and met me at the door. In fact, as I was coming in, and she said, Judge Kreitz, I just wanted to thank you for drug court. I've been clean for now 3 years past graduation, and I'm here today to try and get custody and keep custody of my grandchild.
Wow.
You know, so, and it was nice. I mean, it's very humbling. And I all I said to her was, thank you. We learned more from you than you learned from us. And I'm glad we've been able to assist you. So she's just, those things are nice. I mean, and then you see that you've really made a difference in somebody's life.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So, and just her, but like her grandkids and the people that impact them and the people that impact them, and the people, it's like ripples, right?
Well, and the other thing is these individuals, when they graduate, they have jobs, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of them have a house. They've got their children back together. They're self-sufficient. It's a different way of life than they've ever had to live. And it's just, it's positive. It's really inspiring.
Yeah. I have a question. As I've listened to you both speak, even just briefly here, it's very clear to me that what you're doing is you're creating a sense of psychological safety for these individuals, and you're able to build trust with them. And so they can come in and be treated as individuals, and they sense that you have respect for them. You're not treating them just as a number. You are truly interested in their well-being and their recovery. And what I'm wondering is, what do you do personally before you come into work or before you come into the courtroom that makes you able to be a safe space for them? Do you have any practices or tips for people who are going into encounters with people who are expecting, what was the word you said, Troy? They've had, did you say adversarial experiences with the, so
all of their judicial interactions have been adversarial in nature.
Yeah. So here, you know, you're coming in to work with a person and they may be quite defensive or they may be very beaten down. And is there any practice you have before you come into work or before you come into the room or the courtroom that allows you to be grounded, centered, calm, and safe? Like anything you can share with our listeners, a tip or a practice that you do?
You know, I a lot of times I have to convince myself. We begin staffing at 1 p.m. Every Thursday, and we go through the docket and we discuss every client who's going to appear in court that day. So what I have to do before going into staffing is that I have to make clear in my own mind that I am okay, and I am okay to hear things about other folk, that I can hear those things without interjecting my own judgment of my situation into their lives. So I do a lot of thinking about how I can receive the information that I know I'm going to get. And unlike Judge, I know that Judge looks at the notes a great deal before he goes into court, before he goes into staffing. I don't. I want things to hit me in the moment so that I know kind of what I'm feeling at that time, because it's important for me to be able to take that information in and not have let my day, my week, my month play into that.
Thank you.
Yeah, for me, as Troy said, I mean, like, I guess different ways to look at it. I preparation for staffing is not too difficult for me. I mean, that's just staff. There's no individuals, defendants there. So all we're doing is trying to figure out how they have done like the last 2 weeks, and have they been succeeding? Have they not? What's going on in their lives? And we have a multitude of people there available that provide their professional opinion that are dealing with them on what's going on. And they all get to share. They all got to get their opinions out. And I'm going to try and make it, the staffing, I want to make sure the staff feels comfortable and can speak up and talk, because I kind of direct to different people, but the particular community corrections officer will talk mostly about that individual. But if they've got different therapists, I'll try and reach out to them and say, you know, do you have anything you want to add? Is there something I'm missing here? Is there something we're not doing that we should be doing? And that's how I approach kind of staff. But court, it's like Troy said, the big thing for me is to be organized ahead of time, because things go better if the doc is organized. So I've got a sheet or sheets, like 13 sheets with names in it, all kinds of information. Well, I can't get through all that information in a docket. So I try and focus on things, and I try and remember, I think the big thing for me, at least in my mind, the trigger is that instead of having that adversarial type thing like normal work, which I enjoy, don't get me wrong, I do enjoy it. So, but this is different. I'm trying to be a coach. I'm trying to encourage. I'm trying to do what I can to get these people to succeed in their recovery. And what else can we do to help you that we're not doing, or something we need to do different? And so I try and accentuate positive, pardon me, got a little cold here. So, or allergy probably more likely. But anyhow, that's what I try and do. And that, if I can think about being a coach and being positive, that helps me. And so that's, and I think part of the drug court judge, half of it, if you're doing it right, is you have to be a coach. And the other thing, and maybe this, I'm do this to a fault, maybe another one of my faults, but if they're not succeeding, I'm wondering, what do I need to do differently? What can I do to help them? I mean, what are we missing as a team? Or, you know, and sometimes it's nothing. No, we haven't done anything, but I'm still always searching for things. So, but that's just, I think it's part of the job if you're doing it right. And if you're invested in the program, invested in the individual.
I am curious, you know, because you do have a diverse set of people that you encounter in all of the different dockets that you're responsible for. How have any of these more trauma-informed ways of viewing people shifted your interactions in any of those other dockets?
I think at times it does, especially like I do a lot of child custody visitation mm-hmm. cases, and I think it does somewhat, I know it does affect how I ask questions and how I look at those cases. I think still the most important cases I do are children cases. Mm-hmm. Anything regarding a child to me is the most important. You know, and I was a trial judge on the longest jury trial in Kansas history. But
wow.
To me, that's not, and there was a lot of money at stake there. But that's nothing compared to just a case about kids. The case about those are more important. And here, these individuals and trying drug court where you can actually make a difference in lives. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing. And we see it. That's a difference maker. That's a difference maker, I think, for the entire team. So
yeah. Yeah, that leads me to another question, which is I can only imagine the kinds of stories you hear, the kinds of when you ask people about their trauma, what they tell you, right? Like they tell you then their trauma. And I'm sure there are times you can't help but be impacted on a personal level, right? By those stories you hear. I imagine some of those stories could even be haunting. You know, it's very normal as a human to have an empathy reaction or a stress reaction or to really be grabbed by someone's story and maybe not be able to let it go. Do you have any practices you could share with our listeners for how you kind of release that pain that you've been exposed to at the end of the day, or kind of reset your own nervous system so you can go home and be how you want to be for your family and your friends? Like, how do you like let go of some of that pain you hear?
I'm going to tell a quick story. I'll try to make it as quickly as I can, but I was sitting across the desk from a young man and we were talking about his life, and we got to family and we were talking about trauma stuff, and he told me that both of his parents were deceased. And so I asked him, you know, what happened? And he then says that his father killed his mother, that he found her having an affair with the neighbor. And so he came to the house, shot mom, walked out onto the front porch and shot himself. And so I asked this young man, I said, where were you when all this was happening? And he said he was in the porch swing. So I talked to him about, I said, do you consider that to have been traumatizing in your life? And he didn't. In that moment, he didn't. He didn't. So he wasn't able to connect the fact that this has affected everything that's happened to him since that moment. And so I, a lot of times, have to take that secondary drama and I have to say, you know what, do everything you can to help the folks that are experiencing it, but you can't live it with them, because then it's just going to be traumatizing for you. So I do my best every day, especially when I was a regular everyday line officer, to, when I shut the computer at the end of the day, I was done. I was going home to my wife and my four boys, and it wasn't going to be any more thought of the things that had gone on during the day. I was probably more successful at that some days than others, but it's just, you have to decompress, because if you live this too long, it becomes who you are, not what you do.
That's a good point. It becomes who you are, not what you do.
One that comes to mind was early on when I became a judge. I was interviewing I don't know how old she would have been, probably 16 at that time, in chambers, which is kind of unusual. Normally, they'd testify in court, but the circumstances were just tragic here. And this poor 16-year-old told me that at age of 10, her dad had addicted her to heroin and made her a prostitute to make money. And the way she described it, it was just like it's so matter of fact. And I can remember at the end, you know, telling her that I thought she was a remarkable person. A lot of people couldn't overcome what she did. You know, she was at that point making straight A's at school.
Wow.
And had kind of grounded herself. But no, that was tough for me. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I can't go right back into the courtroom. And so I actually decided I was going to take a little walk outside, you know, and I think people were probably wondering why I was walking. Well, I was walking because I was infuriated and I didn't want to show that in the courtroom, at least immediately, because that wasn't fair to this girl. But, you know, on a daily basis, you know, I try and walk 3 miles in the morning. I lift weights and stretch at night.
Wow.
One of the best therapies for me is if I can go to the golf course and I don't even have to play. I can just go hit golf balls and just literally work on golf shots. If I'm just out there by myself and I can just, it's pretty good therapy for me. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, you've described several practices that help our nervous systems reset. You know, take a moment, take a walk, go hit some golf balls, like get out in nature. I mean, when you're hitting golf balls, I imagine you're out in nature, right? Like you're outside. Those things are really soothing. And the way you both describe this, it reveals to me that you are really mindful. You're like aware of how these things are impacting you and you're making decisions to set boundaries. Like Troy said, work stays at work, you know, or if you find yourself, you know, the word we use in behavioral health is activated, but you know, your nervous system response is activated. Then you didn't just go straight into the courtroom. You were mindful. You're like, what do I need? I need a walk. And I think that kind of, I don't know, what would you call that, Andrea? Would you call that just emotional intelligence or self-awareness?
Yeah.
I think that's really a huge part of being able to be trauma-informed in the work that you do. So thanks for sharing those tips with our listeners.
I'm curious how you are communicating your successes with maybe your local community, but also like the broader, the broader judicial systems. I know, Judge, you mentioned, you know, you'd been to a conference years before. I'm just curious how you all are kind of getting the word out about how impactful and positive this shift in approach is for the people that you serve.
Well, I will say this. I mean, we did have a drug court graduation recently. We had 8 graduates. We had maybe the biggest crowd we've ever had. It's pretty much a standing room only courtroom. We have a large courtroom. And we have visitors there from Washington, D.C. We had some from Lawrence. We had members of a private foundation that you probably know called the Sunfire Foundation. Their people were there. They sat through the whole process of graduations. And at the end, I think the exposure to that, I got an email, they want some sort of presentation, now to their board. Troy does an excellent job sharing so many different things about things. We're both going to a Kansas drug court conference this weekend, which is good because you learn things. There's always something to learn. There's always something you can improve on. When I try and speak when I can about drug court, I've done that quite a bit, different places, and I try and get people to come in and see like graduation, because I think it's important they see it. So, and I've encouraged other judges to create drug courts statewide. So,
and we have a advisory board with Community Corrections and Juvenile Services where we report out our outcomes to local stakeholders and any member of the public as well. So we talk a lot about our success rates with our clientele and the trends that we see and the things that we know we aren't doing particularly well, the things we know we are doing particularly well, and trying to shift our focus throughout the course of each fiscal year to meet the goals that we aren't getting to and the things we aren't doing very well.
Troy, tell us a little bit about the structure of drug court. I'm not sure our listeners know how drug court is different from regular court. So can you tell us what that's like?
Sure. So our drug court is post-conviction. So all of our clients have been convicted of either a drug-related offense. The vast majority of our folks are people that have been convicted of a possession of a controlled substance, whatever that controlled substance is. But we do take other clients that might have property crimes that resulted directly from the use of drugs. They deal so that they can support their habit. Once they are convicted, they come into our program, and our program is a 4-phase program. So it is at least 12 months in length, and the clients are UA'd twice a week.
They UA'd?
The urine analysis.
Oh, urine analysis. Thank you.
Yep. So they are tested for the use of illicit substances twice a week, and they are required to go to treatment. They're required to find employment. They're required to meet with their probation officer. As they work through that progress, you can work through phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, phase 4. Phase 4 is basically you're just preparing yourself for graduation. But throughout the course of that process, they appear in front of the judge in a more, just a give and take. It's not like a normal court appearance. It's a conversation that occurs about what's going on. Now, the judge will be told beforehand, because we have staffing where we discuss every client. We'll say how they've done over the preceding couple of weeks. And then the judge will have a conversation with them in regards to what has happened, get their thoughts on why they're doing well or why they're having the problems that they're having. And then we have a sanctions and incentive grid so we will give them different incentives if they are compliant and doing what they're supposed to. And then also there are sanctions for those who don't do what they're supposed to. And the sanctions include, verbal admonishments, reports, book reports, community service hours, and then eventually they can be sent to jail. We do our level best to never send anybody to jail for more than 5 days because it's incompatible with the idea of a therapeutic court to continually incarcerate our. We do our best not to do that. The day they graduate, they can apply for and receive an expungement, which means that the felony offense is taken off of their criminal history. No longer wow. shows up lawyers, things of that nature. So it, wow. it's a greater incentive. They don't have to wait. In most cases, it's 3 years before you can get an expungement. But if you complete a specialty court program, you're eligible for expungement immediately.
So the process you described really is all about, instead of punishment and compliance, it's about restoration and rehabilitation and bringing people back into, in my mind, I'm seeing, like, instead of setting you aside from society and shaming and blaming, it's like this this process of understanding and pulling you back in, like, you know, wrapping all the supports around you and guiding you on a path to be well, you know, to have a job, to have a home, to get custody of your children back. I mean, whatever is important to you. And then that final thing where you clean the record, you wipe the slate clean. You know, what a fantastic practice this is. And no wonder you're sharing this all around and encouraging other judges to do drug court and inviting the public to celebrate, because this really is, in my opinion, wow, this really is an example of a society doing something that is a kind of community care for members who have, you know, clearly had trauma that has resulted in the things that have happened in their lives. And instead of shaming and blaming and excluding them, we're saying, we understand, we care, you're valuable, and you're still a member of this community. And how can we reintegrate you and wrap these support services around you? So I'm really just very inspired by this.
And absolutely. I mean, you hit the key point. And because, you know, there is some level of pushback mm-hmm. because some of our folks do get a lot of bites at the apple. Mm-hmm. They mess up a lot. Mm-hmm. And we continue to do. We continue to work with them. We continue to work with them. We continue to work with them because we want them to be successful. But my argument to those who have some issue with the amount of leeway sometimes is given to our drug court participants is that these men and women are going to reenter your community mm-hmm. at some point. Whether they go to prison or they don't, they're going to reenter your community. So my question to them would be, would you rather have folks that we are continually working to rehabilitate and make into productive members of society? Or would you rather us just send them to prison, warehouse them for whatever time they're there? Prison is nothing more than college for criminals, and have them come back out even worse than when you sent them in. And if you can't see the relevance of that argument, then I probably am not going to get that idea through your head at all.
Right. Yeah, because it is very countercultural. We have this sort of societal expectation that if you break the law, you're going to be punished. And we want to see that punishment. There's something very, like, I don't know, innate.
Lock them up and throw away the key idea. Yeah. Hard on crime is always popular.
Yeah. And that's just not
good for anyone.
I mean, I think we've seen that time and again, that just doesn't help create a better society.
Not at all.
So, yeah, I really appreciate that perspective.
Well, it's totally a therapeutic model. I mean, that's the idea. We're wanting them to succeed, and we're trying to help them find a way to succeed and find a way inside of them with our assistance where they can succeed. And their success may be different than the person sitting next to them, but if we can get them to succeed in their recovery and get their lives back together and all the pieces back together, it's wonderful. Now, we don't succeed with everybody. That's just a fact. I mean, some people don't make it through drug. It's not an easy road, you know, but we're going to be encouraging them mm-hmm. and we're going to be praising them. Even if they've done something wrong, we're going to try and find something positive for them so they'll at least overcome this and move to the next step. Mm-hmm. So that's our goal anyway.
And I will say, this is something that I like to tout, is the fact that the last three quarters, our drug court has graduated more people than we've unsuccessfully discharged.
Great.
So they get lots of chances, but the vast majority of them eventually take advantage of the opportunities that are provided to them.
One thing that we didn't touch on, just briefly mentioned, when you hear these graduation speeches, it brings tears to your eyes in some of them, some of the things that they've overcome. And so we had an individual that graduated last time that had used drugs, he said in a speech, for over 30 years daily. He's been clean for more than a year. He's got a job. He's got his life back together. And that's due to him, that individual, but also all the work and assistance given by a great staff. Mm-hmm. Who works in that therapeutic model and is mm-hmm. trying to help him. And that's just one of the eight stories.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that came to mind first. I mean, it's just some of the amazing stories. And some of these people that graduate, we've had law enforcement say, we didn't think they would ever see this person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's so encouraging too. And that's encouraging for that individual to hear that, especially from a law enforcement officer. We've had people graduating that invite the people to graduation who arrested them.
Oh, wow. Now that's transformation.
Yeah.
That is transformation right there.
Our last graduation, I remember if it was our last one, the one before, or two times before, because we just had one. But we present them at the end, we present them with a certificate, a challenge coin, a pin from the local mental health center, and a transcript of their final appearance in court that is sent to them along with a letter from the judge. And all of that stuff was presented to this graduate. And I can't remember how the years kind of sneak up on me, but was actually presented to him by the sheriff and the undersheriff of the county from which he was arrested.
Oh my gosh. That is so powerful. What a hope-inducing thing you are doing. I think every success, you keep talking about, you know, the individuals encouraging their successes. And to me, that, why wouldn't I want to live in a society where everyone was successful and everyone was healthy? Like, as each individual gets more healthy and more successful, then all of us have the benefit of that. All of us have the benefit of living in a world that is more healthy and more successful. And I am so grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you so much for being our guests today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
What an inspiring conversation we've had today. I've just been so grateful to share this time with our guests. We have a few takeaways for you. And the first one is, you can't properly address the needs of a client unless you know the trauma they have experienced.
Our second takeaway is really about how to communicate with people and to have a perspective of being a coach versus the referee or the enforcer of the rules, but that you're really in a collaborative opportunity to look at what are those needs and how can we best address those and really hear from the person what their experience has been. And also giving them something positive in return, which has not been their normal experience, you know, recognizing their individuality and their successes, their strengths along the way. And you know, giving that space for sharing and getting the input from others too that are important to that person along the way.
Yes. And the third takeaway has to do with really how we care for ourselves as we do the work. So before going in, taking a moment to set aside everything else so you can really be present, being organized, focusing on being positive, focusing on providing a positive experience for that person, focus on creating a safe space so that the interactions cannot be stress-induced interactions, but rather collaborative and positive interactions. And then after work, leave the work at work. If this work becomes who you are versus what you do, that can impact your well-being. And so finding ways to release the pain you hear, being mindful of how you're being impacted in the moment, and take a time out, take a walk, or at least at the end of the day, get outside, get into nature, go hit some golf balls, find ways to decompress.
And then we have a fourth takeaway today, because there was so much good stuff in this particular conversation, And that fourth takeaway is we really want to encourage people to share the successes that they have in doing these trauma-informed practices, really in whatever organization or whatever system you're working in. Share those successes with other people. Invite people to be part of the celebrations that happen. Invite other people to observe what you're doing and encourage them to take on these practices in their own work.
All right, so we have one final question for our guests. I'm going to ask Troy first. This theme of our series, Trauma-Informed Caring in Unexpected Places, leads me to wonder, what has been unexpected for you in this journey? Can you share anything that's been unexpected or surprising?
What surprised me, as I said when we first started talking, you know, when we started, you know, I did a lot of compliance-based probationary practices. And what surprised me the most was that when we empower the folks that we work with to take their lives back, instead of us taking over their lives for them, their success rates go up exponentially. If you accentuate the things that are doing well and you try to correct the things that they're not doing well, but you need to do that in such a way that you're praising 3, 5 to 10 times more than you're denying the things that they want to do. What I think we will find is that if we empower folks that aren't in a position of power, who aren't in a position of being in control of their lives or having ever had much good things happen to them, if you empower them to have those experiences, they'll want them more often and they will change the people that they are.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, Judge, same question for you. What has been surprising on this journey?
I think basically following what Troy's talking about here, but I thought we would change some lives, but I didn't realize when we started the program, we changed so many in such dramatic ways. And it's from seeing people at the total bottom of life, you get to a place where they're enjoying life and they're doing well and they've recovered or they're in recovery. They're always going to be in recovery. But that's probably the biggest takeaway for me. I thought it would be a success, but see, it's a bigger success. I mean, you're actually changing lives in a lot of positive ways. So.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you both for being part of this episode and the wonderful work that you're doing in your community.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us once again for Trauma-Informed Caring. We invite you to check out the resources that are available on the Mid-America ATTC website. You can also access our virtual room of refuge, where you can find a variety of support for your own well-being, access our YouTube channel, and subscribe to our newsletter, Conscious Connection. Thanks for joining us. It is our hope that where you work and where you live, this podcast will offer you practical support for the practice of trauma-informed caring.